Good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2, talking to you about healthcare and fitness trends and taking your phone calls. Today's show is about creating an allergy and toxic-free home and work environment. With me in the studio is environmental building consultant David Kibbe, author and editor of the ADPSR, which stands for Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility, West Coast Architectural Resource Guide. As usual, I'll open up the phone lines roughly at 2:40 for your participation in the show. And that number, again, whether you're in the area code or elsewhere, is 510-848-4425. And a reminder to those of you who may want to get a tape of today's show if you missed some of the material, or if you need more information, you can call my information line during normal business hours, and that number is 707-769-1458. And I'll give it out again at the end of the show. Just briefly, the reason I wanted to do the show is that we've been dealing during this El Nino with terrible water damage problems in people's homes. And I think that what happens when people feel poorly, they sometimes overlook that the fact that that your home or work environment may actually be causing you some physical distress. It's symptoms that come from this type of exposure are remarkably similar to what can happen when people have some kind of pathology, some kind of hormonal imbalance, or even immune dysfunction and allergies. These symptoms are remarkably similar, and so people sometimes don't think about their indoor air quality or their environment around them. Allergic reactions don't always present with respiratory symptoms. An allergy to molds, for instance, can sometimes make an individual feel inconsolably depressed. Dust can cause abdominal distress, and chemical exposure sometimes feels like a gnawing in your stomach, or it can give you a hoarse throat. Uncovering the source of your discomfort may require looking at a variety of factors, and today we'll examine what to do if you discover that your home or your office is causing you symptoms. David Kibbe was kind enough to join us in person, so welcome to you.
Thank you, Lena.
And let me give you an introduction here. David Kibbe is a former sculptor, college professor, and exhibit director whose last 23 years have been devoted to hands-on design, problem-solving, and building in the Bay Area. He is a healthy building consultant, environmental building inspector, author, and educator dedicated to healthier homes and workplaces. David is a graduate of Boston University and Rhode Island School of Design, has participated in numerous conferences on ecological architecture, and has completed environmental building seminars with U.S. EPA, University of Tulsa, Institute for the Biology and Ecology.
It means building biology.
Water Loss Institute and Safe Environments. He is a board member of the Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility, editor and author of the ADPSR Architectural Resource Guide. He's a consultant for Safe Environments, Home and Office Testing Laboratories, and founder of his own consultation and inspection service. David teaches workshops on healthy building materials for various educational institutions and speaks at conferences, government organizations, colleges, and universities, and is currently collaborating on a traveling exhibition of sustainable building materials for Alameda County Waste Management Authority. I feel like we should have a round of applause now. good intro there. It's interesting when we talked about this stuff, when we started to talk on the phone, and I've interviewed you before, and I know you. I've actually used your services. So what happens when we start looking at home environments is that we're looking at a situation, as we do with this show, that exists in the same way that the body exists, that nothing happens alone. Everything is related to other things. So I'd like you to talk about how the elements interconnect in a home environment, and then we might use that as a way to talk about how irritants in an indoor environment affect each other and how that affects the air quality.
Sure. I think you've touched on the key to the whole issue of indoor air quality and healthful building interiors. And I think that, like so many areas of knowledge, nothing is separate from anything else, and everything is interconnected. No part of the building can be isolated and said to be the key factor in the health of the people who are residing or working in the building. And an example of that is, for instance, you may think about the heating system as being simply a means of heating a cool building, or in the summertime, if there's an air conditioner, cooling a warm building, as if it somehow were just a piece of machinery that is separate from the structure of the house, the skeleton of the house, the skin of the house, and the stuff of the house. But if you think about it, those ducts through which that air passes are actually part of the indoor air. Now, usually the return air in most buildings is in the floor. It's low to the ground, and it's a place where, by gravity, it collects everything you can imagine. Spores of mold, dust, the droppings from dust mites, sometimes even rodent droppings, and occasionally mice will nest in that little area.
You're talking about in the ducts of the heating system?
In the ducts of the heating system, and particularly in the return duct, which is on the floor. And because of gravity, food particles, cat hair, dog hair, skin flakes, anything you can imagine, probably the worst things you can imagine, all go into this and become then airborne in this duct, which is really part of your indoor air. It then goes to the furnace heats it up.
Right.
If there are any chemicals involved, if you've dropped a crayon in there or a marking pencil, for instance, now it is heated. And those fumes, once they are heated, can combine with other elements that are in the air and create new compounds, which now are forced through the supply ducts.
Well, part of what you're saying here is, I mean, we'll go on and we'll talk really specifically about heating ducts, but you're talking about, in the beginning of what you said, you also indicated that just the way that the heat is created is one issue, and then, as you said, there's the skin of the house and the different layers of insulation, which can do things like gather moisture, and so it's not just that, it's everything altogether.
There are some principles of physics which are really quite abstract, and we tend not to think about them when we're sitting comfortably or not comfortably in our house. But the physics have to do with things like airflow, moisture flow, relative humidity, have to do with the various chemical interactions that are taking place within the air and within the objects that are in the house, things like carpets off-gassing, dry cleaning chemicals coming off your jackets in the closet, leaking gas from your stove. All of these kinds of things can be creating a whole kind of chemical interesting development inside your air. And there are elements of temperature, everything. Just particularly, I guess the thing that I run into the most are buildings that have materials that are off-gassing.
Right.
And the second most frequent thing that I run into, and perhaps more than usual this year because of El Nino, are buildings that have mold problems or water damage problems. And again, these things are not simply a matter of where the water came in and created mold, but then as it gets involved in the heating and ventilating system, as it gets involved in the circulation of air throughout the building, then it starts to become interconnected with other things, and sometimes it's very hard to isolate exactly what's going on.
Well, and it also gets complicated because, on the one hand, buildings have become better insulated, and that can be bad news as well as good news, because having an airtight house, if there is this chemical soup developing in the midst of the air and in the heating and in the humidity, then you've got yourself held in. But the other side of it is that in a year like this with El Nino, you've got all these mold spores outside as well, or during the summer you've got pollens. So I guess what I'm asking is two things. One is it better to go ahead and try to be airtight? Is it prudent not to? Can you be too airtight?
This is a really interesting question, because I often pass out a handout at classes I teach, and the number one item among the 11 most common hazards for environmental problems in buildings, I name as tight buildings. And of course, immediately, those who are seriously concerned with the environmental impact of energy use in buildings jump at me and say, what do you mean tight buildings? That should not be the number one cause of environmental problems. That should be the number one effort that we try to make in order to save energy in the construction and fabrication of our buildings. And I have to agree that that is the key element in saving energy and in creating environmentally sound buildings. I have to disagree only to the point that when a building is tight, if it is poorly ventilated, then all those synthetic building materials that now proliferate in our buildings that didn't several years ago start to become a chemical problem. So it really is not a question of this. I guess what it is it illustrates the first question that you asked, how everything is connected. These things are inextricably connected, and it's important to address both.
Okay,
we must address the energy, and we must also address the ventilation.
Okay, but also I think what I want to do is I want to go back to the mold stuff, but before we do, what we'll also try to unpack as we're talking is the fact that there are a number of products now available that are less toxic and even non-toxic. So potentially somebody with, you have a partner who has multiple chemical sensitivities. Some people have mold and pollen allergies. They have lots of that stuff, inhalant allergies. For them, perhaps, if the indoor quality is protected, having an insulated building at certain times of the year may be good, because the outside there's things too that could affect you.
One of the best ways to create healthy air is first to reduce toxic sources.
Mm-hmm.
Second, if you can't reduce those sources, to in some way isolate them.
Right.
And a tight building is one way to isolate. If you have tight walls, then things inside the walls cannot be forced into the air. And the third is to ventilate, therefore diluting any problem, chemical or mold that is in the air with fresh air. So what happens is, in a properly ventilated, tight building, it means that you can then control the ventilation. And controlled ventilation is an important thing to have. A loose building, an old building that has very loose walls and windows and poor insulation and so on, is not necessarily a better ventilated building, but it is a building with more infiltration.
Okay, well I don't want this to get so complicated that people give up.
Sure.
So let's go back to something they can relate to, which is we've just had a year of just deluged with rain. The tightest house is likely to begin to have some water problems that people may not have been aware of, or they may have been aware of them and now they're really bad. So mold exposure, whether I don't know if people realize this, even in healthy individuals can cause some degradation of the immune system. It's rather irritating to everybody. So the first thing is keeping water out of the house. Why don't you talk about some of the basic principles in a house in an accessible way to
Sure.
people without experience of this sort of moisture flow and pressure and stuff?
Sure. As you say, for mold to exist, there must be moisture. If there has been mold, if there is not moisture, then it will stay and it will wait until there is moisture, even 100 years from now. When moisture comes in a place where there has been mold, there will be mold again. So the issue is, number one, keep the water out. So now, I just have come from a house yesterday where the crawl space beneath the house has been flooded with deep water throughout the whole El Nino season. That means that mold is growing on all of the material underneath the house. It means that in some cases, the furnace ducts have been submerged in water,
Oops.
Which means that there is mold growing inside those ducts. Because as we know, most ducts leak. So the issue is, how can we get rid of the water? In their house, what we're doing is we're working on stopping the drainage from going back underneath the house. So we are grading the soil away from the edge of the house. We're undergrounding the tubes that come from the downspouts, from the gutters, from the roof. We're adding French drains around the outside perimeter of the foundation so that the water that does get next to the foundation is drained harmlessly away to a point in daylight well away from the house. We're putting a polyethylene vapor retarder over the entire exposed soil area of the floor. And the ultimate...
You're talking about in the crawl space.
In
now.
The crawl space, mm-hmm. Yes. And the other thing that we're doing is we're replacing any of those ducts that have been submerged in water. We're testing the rest of them for the presence of mold, cleaning them, tightening them up so that moldy and moist air does not get into them, sealing them really well. And that's an important thing that most people don't know about. But the ultimate thing that we're doing for this house is we're putting a fan in the crawl space that blows out. And instead of opening the vents that let fresh air in, we're actually closing most of them up.
Oh, that's unusual.
And the reason for that is that when the fan blows out, it creates a negative pressure. It's like letting all the air out of a basketball. You now have no air, no pressure in the crawl space. And when that's the case, the mold goes out.
Okay. For those of you tuning in, this is Your Own Health and Fitness, and I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman with Environmental Building Specialist David Kibbe. And we're doing a show about protecting your home and work environment from pollutants and organic materials like mold so that you don't have an allergic or toxic environment. And we're talking about moisture, getting moisture out. Okay. That's interesting about the fan. In my own home, I put the Vesqueen down as a vapor barrier, and I did the thing of draining the water away from my house. But the thing that was very profound was it was just getting the vapor barrier down in the crawl space. It was a phenomenal thing. And then I just added lots of vents, so I have tremendous ventilation under there. It sounds to me like the reason for the fan is when the heating ducts are down there. Is that the point?
When the heating ducts are down there, and in this case it's the supply ducts, the ones that are sending the hot air from the furnace or the cool air from the air conditioner, those ducts are positively pressurized. That is, they're blowing air. And the crawl space then becomes positively pressurized through all of the leaks, so it's blowing the mold upstairs. So what we're trying to do is to get the crawl space to suck while the house blows. That way, the mold goes out of sight, out of mind, and the inside of the house then is getting fresh air from the windows and from ventilation inlets.
Okay, so what we're talking about now is if you own your own home, which is not the case with many people who are listening today, you get the water away and you deal with the crawl space, and if you've got ducts down there, you might want to do what you just suggested. Now, there are a lot of people who are renting, so they don't have control over it. In addition to that, there's some in apartments. So let's talk about, because we just talked about the things that are more, maybe bigger to do. Let's talk about the little things that people can do just in terms of controlling humidity in the house if they don't have control over the environment the way you would if you owned your house.
Some very simple things. If you have a fan in your bathroom, an exhaust fan in your bathroom, every time you take a bath or a shower, a huge amount of moisture is released into the air, which always causes mold. If you always have the exhaust fan on for up to 20 minutes after you have taken a bath or a shower, you'll do probably the most you could possibly do for reducing relative humidity and causes for mold. Now, the problem is, when you do that, you are sucking air out of the bathroom. And so you need to allow air back in. Every cubic foot out has to have a cubic foot coming back in. So if you have both a window and a fan, you should crack the window open. If you do not have a window, but you do have a fan, turn on the fan and open the door and let the air from another part of the house come in to replace that which is being exhausted.
Is it the case that keeping a not very powerful bulb on, an electric bulb, a light on in the bathroom during potential moldy times is helpful?
Where I find that's most useful is in a crawl space or in a closet.
Oh.
And if you think about closets, generally, they're often on an outside wall, and they often have the door closed, so you don't see all those messy clothes in there. That means that the warmth of the room is not passing through the door into the closet. The closet's a colder temperature. A colder temperature means a higher relative humidity, and if you look at your shoes, you'll often see mold growing on them. If that's the case, then number one, keep the door open if you can. And number two, leave a light on, because mold does not like light. It generates a little bit of heat, which brings up the temperature, which will, to some degree, reduce the relative humidity, given the fact that there's a moisture load in the air already. So it's a very simple thing. Leave the light on in the closet.
And maybe in a small bathroom as well.
Or in a small bathroom.
Yeah.
Crawl spaces, it actually helps,
crawl
too.
Crawl space. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the other thing that may be useful is this business of controlling humidity, and if you don't know, you can get a little gauge, I guess, too.
Yeah, there are in a number of, stores, electronic device stores and so on, or specialty mail order houses and so on, you will find little hygrometers that are very simple. They cost $15 or $20. They tell you what the temperature is in Fahrenheit, and they tell you what the relative humidity is in percentages. And what you look for is an ideal of 50% relative humidity. That is the most comfortable, the most humane, and the healthiest level of humidity. If it's over 60%, you are guaranteed to have mold. If it is under 30%, you will probably exacerbate any kind of respiratory conditions you have, or asthma, or problematic health conditions.
So the other thing that you can do is either get a dehumidifier or a humidifier, depending on what's going on.
First, I would use the bathroom fan, use the kitchen stove hood fan, remember the makeup air through opening a window slightly, and if that is not enough, if your gauge is showing consistently over 60% humidity during an El Nino season or a winter season, then you might need to think about something like a dehumidifier.
Okay. The other thing that appears helpful is to, this seems like a no-brainer, to keep the house or the apartment warm.
To a certain degree, yes. If it is within a comfort range of between 68 and 72, then generally the relative humidity will be more acceptable, given the amount of moisture load we have in the wintertime here, than it would be if you had the room at a conservative, say, 55 or 60 degrees. What happens at that point is the same amount of moisture load actually creates a much more likelihood of condensation to take place on the windows. So you see all that wetness on the windows, landing on the windowsills. If you look closely at it, you'll probably see penicillium,
right,
cladosporium,
so
any
of
the other common
molds. Because we're starting to move into then how to clean your house. I notice we're spending the entire show talking about mold, and I want to get on to a little bit about chemicals. But maybe we're getting into chemicals now by talking about this. Okay, so you've got this sort of little spots of mold on your window or on your windowsill. You clean it with what?
Hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah, so interesting.
Is the safest thing. You can clean it with household bleach. But the problem with household bleach is that even at low dilutions, it smells pretty bad. You'll notice that right away. But it also, for people with chemical sensitivities, can be really quite toxic. And that smell, those odors, the chemical components of household bleach, can be absorbed in things like wood and curtains and carpets and furniture and so on, and continue to off-gas for some time. The hydrogen peroxide is actually not quite as strong a biocide. It doesn't kill mold quite as fast, but it does a pretty good job, and it does it much more safely, being careful, of course, not to get it on your hands or on your skin, because it will burn a little bit. It's a caustic material.
Hydrogen peroxide 3%?
Yeah. If you just leave your hand exposed to it, it'll start to bubble away on your hand, and it will hurt a little bit. So wear rubber gloves and protect your eyes.
This is 100% solution of this 3%.
Yes, what you buy in the grocery store is going to be 3% solution, which is a pretty dilute solution, but it's enough so that it will bleach colors out of building materials or out of fabrics. And it can sting a little bit when it hits your hand. You don't want to get it in your eyes.
Okay, so we like hydrogen peroxide better than bleach. And then there are other substances that I assume don't work quite as well, maybe, which are borax, baking soda, grapeseed.
Probably, if we were to go in order of effectiveness, and probably also in order of least toxicity, or from most to least toxicity, we go chlorine bleach, then hydrogen peroxide. Then there's a product called Zephyrin.
Zephyrin. Mm-hmm. Z-E-P-H-R-I-N. It's not easy to find, but you get it.
I think it's I-R-A-N.
I'm sorry, you're right. Z-E-P-H-R-I-N. He's correct.
And then after that is grapefruit seed extract, which is also a biocide. The other ones that you mentioned, the borax and baking soda, will help clean surfaces, and cleaning surfaces is a good way to remove surface mold. They won't particularly have a biocide effect.
Now, you listed bleach first, even though you think it's a little toxic.
It's the strongest.
It's the best one, huh?
It's the strongest.
What solution of bleach do you use?
As dilute as you can.
Oh.
Probably from what you get in the chlorine bottle, the bleach bottle, you could make it as dilute as 50 to 1. It would be a little more effective if you did it at 20 to 1.
Okay. And
10 to 1 would be very, very, very strong, and you need to watch out for it.
Now, washing windows, I'm assuming that using vinegar, which is a good thing to wash windows with, it's not toxic, does that kill mold too?
It is a reasonably good mild biocide, okay, and it will help remove the mold.
Okay.
The thing to watch out for, of course, is using household window cleaners that have ammonia in them if you have just cleaned with Clorox.
Really?
Because when you mix chlorine and ammonia, you get deadly chloramine gas.
How long do you have to wait after using bleach on the windows before you can use a window cleaner?
Well, I guess until it's completely dry.
Dry.
And probably, you know, okay, probably then some.
Then some. This is all very similar to what you'd be using if you start to see mold spores on your, God forbid, your walls, mm-hmm, which is not a good sign. The same sorts of materials, washing the walls with them.
I think what we might mention here is that if you see mold on your walls, then that is one of the last surfaces it forms on. It means it probably is in the gypsum material of the drywall. It's probably in the paint, perhaps even on the backside of the paint. If you have wallpaper, it's quite easily on the backside of the wallpaper. It could be on the inside of the drywall or plaster, and it could easily be inside the wall partitions. If you have had flooding, that is almost guaranteed to be the case. You need to remove those materials.
Okay, and then when we come back, we're going to take a little 30-second break here, and when we come back, what we'll do is finish talking about getting mold out of walls, and then maybe do just a touch on some of the chemical toxics found in building materials and safer materials. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, your own health and fitness. We're talking with building consultant, natural building consultant David Kibbe about a non-toxic home, and we'll be right back.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm on and right, where I belong.
Welcome back. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. This is your own health and fitness. I'm here live in the studio with environmental building inspector and consultant David Kibbe, who is author of a book called The Architectural Resource Guide. This was produced by the Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility. It's a it has a sort of a couple of pages about each type of building material that's available and different things, and then it lists all the different kinds of resources for sustainable, non-toxic, natural. It discusses the benefits and shortcomings of each one. This is incidentally available through the organization, with the number of the planners and the designers and everybody all being socially responsible. And I'm going to give you a couple of numbers to reach. This resource is also available on a database if you want, or you can get a little, it's not little, it's a big booklet actually. So I'll give this out at the end of the show again, but let's give it out now. If you want a copy of this, it's several pages. It's quite useful. You can order it by calling David, and you can also David Kibbe, and he can also be reached for consultations and is willing to give 5 minutes to people who have questions beyond what we can cover on the show. His number is 510-841-1039. Again, that's 510-841-1039. He's also listed in Berkeley as David Kibbe, K-I-B-B-E-Y. You can also call Daryl DeBauer?
DeBauer.
Daryl's number is 510-865-399, I'm sorry, 3669, 865-3669. And for Daryl, this would be to order, again, the Architectural Resource Guide.
I might add to that, Lena, the general number for ADPSR for information is 510-273-2428.
Why don't you do that again?
That's 510-273-2428.
As usual, what I do is give the receptionist at the front desk of KPFA a sheet that she can look up whatever was presented on my show. So from week to week, she has a binder. So if people really get flummoxed and they're very confused, you can also call our main number and ask and dial the operator. The main number at the desk of KPFA is 510-848-6767, and you dial 0 for the operator and ask her to look it up in the binder. So we've been talking about walls, and the bad news is if you're seeing mold on the walls, it's pretty invasive at that point. Now, if you own your house, there's a bunch of things you can do. If you don't own your house, what do you do?
If you don't own your house, then you need to look for the same things that a person who owns their house does.
Okay.
And essentially, we're talking about, first, remove sources of moisture.
Okay, so you go back to that.
Second, remove any materials that have been damaged by moisture. So if you have a rug that's been soaked in water, then it's best to just throw it away. Might be possible to clean it. But in most cases, if it's been water damaged, it should be thrown away. If it is possible to use things like bathroom fans to reduce moisture, then that is something that anybody can
do. Okay, so the same stuff we covered before, but
so
you've got the mold on the wall. So
that's right. If you've got it on the wall, then again, you can use hydrogen peroxide
clean
to
it.
Clean the surface.
Clean it all.
But ultimately, you need to stop the moisture first,
okay.
Then clean up whatever is left, and then try to maintain conditions where your humidity is under control.
Okay, you own the house. What do you do?
Well, if you own the house, then, again, the house is like a human being. It's like an organism of its own. It has a skin. It has a hat. Its hat is most important. So it needs a really good roof. If you've got a leaky roof, you've got mold. So maintaining roof condition, maintaining flashings, keeping the leaves out of the gutter, making sure the downspouts from the gutter are free and flowing and not clogged. It's best if they can be connected to tubes that take the water away from the foundation of the house. If that cannot be done, then at the very least you can attach one of these plastic socks to the bottom of the tube, which will unroll and take the water away from the foundation of the house. If you have a wet crawl space,
right.
If you can stop drainage problems that are getting into it,
but
that would be good.
What about the mold on the wall? Do you have to take the wall apart?
Well, if you have water-damaged walls, the first and most critical rule of thumb is that damaged materials, if they're soft, if they're plastery, if they're fuzzy materials, they need to be removed and disposed of carefully and then replaced after having taken care of the moisture problem. First, moisture's got to be gone. Second, damaged materials must be gone. And then third, maintenance conditions that will maintain relative humidity.
There are a number of products available now, many of which are listed in this resource guide that we gave the number for, the Architectural Resource Guide. In addition to that, there's a number of products that there's starting to be some consciousness among building materials. But there are a lot of things that are confusing for people in terms of what sorts of materials are going to be the most. I mean, like, I know that insulation can be incredibly toxic, for instance. So why don't you tell us, in terms of what things to look out for when you're starting to do repairs, what are the most toxic things to avoid?
What any indoor air quality specialist will tell you in response to that question is that the materials which cover the most surface, that take up the most volume, that are most prevalent within your, particularly your indoor air, are the ones that are the most important. So it, in a way, though insulations are important, what's more important is the paint on the wall.
Uh-huh.
And though insulations under the floor may be important, and maybe siding and plywood and roof materials and so on the outside of the house are important, it's the floor covering that covers the most of the square footage of your floor. And so if you have carpets, that is a really serious issue.
Or if you have bare floors, the varnishes.
Or if you have bare floors, what has been used to finish those floors? And there are good alternatives.
And for paints, we now have actually a couple of mainstream brands. I think the best of which is the Glidden. Here I am giving out a brand name, but Glidden 2000, I think, which is one of the low odor paints. What are they doing to paint that makes them less toxic? When you're using a latex paint, I know there are natural paints which don't always agree with everybody.
You're right. This is one brand. There are a number of brands, and more paint companies are now coming up with zero VOC, zero petroleum solvent paints that are very low odor, that are fast curing, and that do not seem to affect people with chemical sensitivities as much as standard paints do. And there, I can think of four or five brands right off the top.
But what are they doing? Aren't they removing the moldicides?
Well,
which seems
actually they're not. There are still some toxic substances in these paints. And if you were to talk to a scientist about what's in the paint, you would see that they have not removed all of the volatile organic compounds or VOCs, but they have removed the ones that the state considers to be controllable VOCs. So zero VOC does not necessarily mean there are no volatile organic compounds. It means that the most common ones are missing. It also means that petroleum solvents have not been used, and they've reformulated in such a way to make them so that they work well, but they don't smell bad. This was done for outdoor air quality purposes, but it works for indoor.
Okay, and there are better and worse ones, and some of the, it depends on, yeah.
What's critical right. is that every person is different, and therefore, and every paint formula is different, and so you'll find that some work well for one person, and others work well for another person.
Okay. My impression is that one of the places that you can also get into big trouble is with the glues and the formaldehydes in wood products.
Yeah, a lot of plywoods and composite wood products that are made from sawdust or shavings or chips
strand
are
particle
glued
board.
Together under pressure and temperature with usually a urea formaldehyde glue for interior panels. Urea formaldehyde is a chemical problem. It's a carcinogen. It's chemically, you know, chemically sensitizing and so on. So there are some alternatives that are made with either phenol formaldehyde, which is the exterior version of that glue, or with non-formaldehyde type glues.
Another thing I discovered was that there are products made by companies which are less toxic. There's a whole line of products. They're listed again in the book. There's one brand, AFM, which is listed in the book that does a line of. Anyway, they do a topical coat, which is a plastic sealant. And I've noticed in my experience that when you seal a piece of plywood with that, it seals out the smell.
The rule of thumb, again, is if you can not have a source of emissions, that's best.
Better.
But if you must, then that is certainly one approach to isolate it,
okay.
to seal it with and what's known as an environmental sealant. And AFM is one company, and there are several other companies that make clear sealants that will seal in noxious fumes.
Okay, now we have about 2 minutes left. What are the most exciting materials that are coming out? What are you most excited about in terms of sustainability?
Oh, you know, there's one. There's a fellow here in Berkeley who's doing the most wonderful work. He's found a way to make countertops out of lightweight concrete by using the aggregate, the little stone shapes that are in the concrete, made from recycled glass or recycled shaved pieces of copper or brass or anything else recycled you want. And he makes it like terrazzo floors. It's a highly polished, custom-made counter material. Very hard, very resilient, extraordinarily beautiful, and all using recycled materials and non-toxic.
And there's also a lot of wood products that are coming out that seem to be better, because wood is getting restrictively expensive. So when you go to get like decking material, you can get things that are kind of a mixture of things that are recycled and stuff, huh?
Well, and again, they're... The best wood, of course, is old growth wood that is no longer sustainably harvested. But if, for instance, you can salvage old wood.
Recycled wood.
And, yes, recycled wood or resurfaced, refinished old wood, sometimes even wood that's been raised up from the bottoms of streams, then that's certainly an ideal way to go. But what's really exciting, too, is that there are some new materials being made out of agricultural fibers instead of wood.
That's what I was wondering
made about. Made from hemp, made from, or wood scraps that are glued together with soy-based, non-petroleum-type glues, non-formaldehyde-type glues.
Good use for
beautiful
soy.
Materials. A lot of exciting new entrepreneurial work is being done in this field.
Okay, and some of this information is available in the Architectural Resource Guide. Again, a couple of numbers. As I quickly open the book for people to... Incidentally, we are going to open the phone lines now. It's an area code. It's 510-848-4425. Again, 848-5544. Ooh, 848-4425 in the 510 area code. Again, this is your own health and fitness, and I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, live in the studio with environmental building consultant David Kibbe. If you want to order this resource guide, either on a database or in a booklet form, you can call David Kibbe, and you can also get information from David Kibbe on his services, and he may give you an extra 5 minutes to help you if you don't get through today. His number, which is also listed in Berkeley, California, is 510-841-1039, 841-1039 in the 510. If you just want a copy of the resource guide and you can't get through to David, you can call Daryl at 510-865-3669. 8-653-6669 in 510. Let's get to some of these impatient callers. We've got Harry in Concord.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I live in an apartment, and my problem is excessive dryness. A wet washcloth will be bone dry by morning, and I have musical instruments that need some humidity, and where the hell do you get a hygrometer in California?
Well, you can get a hygrometer at...
What is a hygrometer,
A hygrometer guys? Is an instrument that will measure the relative humidity.
Right.
In the room, and you can get one at dare I say the name of a common radio supply store,
that's okay.
Radio Shack.
Oh,
and they cost about $50 and $30 or something like that. But let me just mention something briefly about dryness. Often, people who perceive dryness in their indoor environment will think that the thing to do is to put a kettle of water in the stove and mix a water mist into the air. And the danger with that is that you then add mold to the air. Often the perception of dryness is much more a matter of the way the breezes or the drafts or the ventilation are in the room rather than actual relative humidity. So your response to look for a hygrometer is probably the first thing to do. If it is below 30% relative humidity, then you may need to look at ways to increase the humidity. But in most cases, it's going to be a matter of looking at the other systems in your building to find a way to maximize what you have already.
Yeah, I'll have to order a humidifier. I know that because
yeah,
it's hard to find anything like this in California. I've tried.
Yeah, it's
thanks.
Pretty
okay,
rare.
Harry, thank you. Let's move on to Donna in Berkeley.
Hi. I'm curious. There was a while when I couldn't listen, and I'm not sure if you talked about it, but I heard the first part of the show. You know, when you talked about the duct, and all the various and sundry things that can be blown into the house through the ducts. My question is, what, if anything, is the usefulness of these services that you see advertised? I just think I saw one a day or two ago in the paper where they say that they're going to come into the house and use, I guess, high-power vacuums and/or filters. I don't know what they exactly use, but they have it ends up costing about $100, and they supposedly clean out all the ducts. What do you think about that?
This is a very good question, and it's a key question. If ducts are cleaned improperly or irresponsibly, they can raise the dust, they can raise the spores of mold or even bacteria that can be present inside the ducts, and spread them all around throughout the house. So what is absolutely critical is, number one, that the ducts be inspected for condition. They should be sealed so that they do not leak. Then the responsible way to clean them is with a HEPA-filtered vacuum system that isolates all of the air that's drawn out of the ducts and captures all the particulate matter in a very, very clean way.
Rather than blowing it out the back the way a typical
for your
right.
neighbors, yeah.
The best services will have a HEPA vacuum mounted on a truck,
uh-huh.
and they will isolate the duct so that the air does not get blown throughout the house, and one by one they'll extract all the dirty material from the ducts. But let's get back to the basic first part of your question is, does it really work? Well, yes, it can work, but no, it doesn't necessarily improve the efficiency of your furnace. It does not necessarily remove the conditions that could be causing mold in your house. So it may help, but it could easily cause more harm than good. And I do know a number of people who've really suffered extreme illness after having their ducts cleaned. There is an organization called the National Association of Duct Cleaners, NADC.
Sounds like something on Garrison Keillor.
It does. If there is a duct cleaner who belongs to that organization and follows their code of ethics and practice, then you'll probably be in pretty good shape.
Well, without ripping up your house, how would anybody inspect every duct? I mean, the whole nature of ducts is that they're, you know, enfolded into the...
they're hidden away in the interstitial spaces of the building. The way ducts are inspected essentially is by two methods. It can be done by putting a remote video camera into a little a robot monitor that goes through the ducts and looks at them from inside. And many duct cleaning companies have that equipment as a regular part of their service.
Uh-huh.
Or the other thing is to measure with pressures. And there are instruments that can measure the pressure of a duct to see if it's leaking. And it's pretty easy to tell that way with what's called a blower door test.
There are also alternative heating sources, and there are people who specialize in that. One thing that I considered and actually did in my own house is that I got a boiler instead of a furnace because I didn't have ducting in my house. And I have little baseboard heaters with forced water. And the boiler is twice as expensive as a furnace, but the rest of the cost was equal to putting in any kind of central heating. I have a small place, so it worked out for me. But forced water or radiant heat. Anyway, alternative sources of heat is another thing to look at when people are sensitive. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Robert in Berkeley.
Good afternoon. I've got a southern exposure wall that emits a strong resin-like odor when it heats up in the afternoon. And I'd like to get the air checked, but I don't know who to call or, you know, I guess EPA would have been my first choice, but somehow I doubt that they are going to come out to my apartment and check my air. Who should I go to?
Let me try to understand what it is in the air that you want to check.
It smells like a resin or glue light. I think what's happening is some kind of building material in the wall itself is heating up in the sunlight later in the afternoon, and the bathroom becomes filled with a very strong, so strong that I have to actually leave the fan on in there. Resin, it smells like a resin, like, you know, it's hard to explain, but kind of an aromatic, you know, glue-like. It's not something I've ever experienced from anything I've bought from a store.
Right. Has any work been done on the building recently?
They did do some work on the roof, but it doesn't smell like tar. It doesn't really smell like a petroleum product.
They didn't do any work on the siding or windows or
wall
material?
Not that I know of. But it's been, you know, I would thought that maybe after heating up a few times it would dissipate, but it seems like it's not doing that.
Right, yeah. It's hard to say without inspecting it, without looking visually at it, or without perhaps even doing what we call intrusive disassembly, looking into the inside of the wall to find out what
you
is actually in there.
You can't test the air quality in his room?
Well, the problem with testing the air quality with anything other than your nose is that you're looking for unknown substances, and this can be an extraordinarily expensive process, and it may not tell you anything. One of the things I keep learning as I go to more and more conferences on indoor air quality from EPA and various universities is that essentially what testing is for is to disprove hypotheses. It is not necessarily to tell you anything direct. So to test in this case, I think we need to know what we're looking for and then try to test for specific things.
Well,
so it's pretty hard to do.
What would you do if you were Robert?
I know that if I were there and if I were inspecting it, I would look for, from my experience, all the materials that might possibly be off-gassing once they heat up. So it would be anything that once was a wet material.
But basically what we're saying is he can hire a consultant to come and look at the place, but it should be someone who's like you, an environmental building consultant.
Yeah, and there are a number of different varieties. There are industrial hygienists. There are people like me who simply look primarily visually from our experience at building materials and healthfulness. And there are also physicians who make house calls and actually look for allergenic properties inside buildings.
Cool.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Let's go to Alfredo in Mountain View.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could enlighten me a little bit more about hemp. And if you don't mind, I would like to also, if I could tell you there's going to be a hemp expo in Santa Cruz at the Civic Center Auditorium coming March 21st, and I wanted to pass that along maybe so people will know. But what I wanted to know is a little more about the misconception that is out there about hemp, this being that the plant comes from the...
Well, you know what? That's another show. Yeah. But what we can talk about, Alex, is how it's used in building materials.
Perfect.
That we can discuss.
Yeah, and I think this is a very good point, that among the most exciting new materials available are materials made from industrial hemp, which, as you point out, is not the same thing as the kind of marijuana.
You can't smoke
that,
the building materials.
You can't smoke these. They wouldn't do you any good. In fact, when you try to grow industrial hemp next to marijuana, it kills the marijuana because it shades out the plants. But at any rate, and I don't know that much about it, except that I have seen a number of the hemp materials, all the way from fibrous materials like carpets and upholsteries to materials like boards, building boards, floor covering materials, and a number of really interesting materials that are now coming on the market more and more.
Are limitless. There's so many mm-hmm. things that you can do.
It's exciting stuff.
Well, so I really thank you for pointing out that this hemp expo is going to be taking place in Santa Cruz. And you will find that more and more of this sort of thing is happening.
What was it, March 21st?
March
21st and the 22nd.
Okay. Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Alex,
thank
you.
Thanks.
Bye. Oh, I'm sorry, Alfredo, thanks. Now we have Alex to thank. Alex.
Hi, I was just curious if you have any knowledge about devices that can be used to retrofit into forced air heating.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there are some. Do you know about those?
Now, are you thinking in terms of filtration?
Filtration? I don't know. I had the idea of, you know, something I was just kind of pondering, maybe something that was almost like a catalytic converter as well as a filtration device that could actually alter the chemistry of the air.
Okay, a couple of really important points here. I think one thing that can certainly be done after the fact with existing duct systems is there are a variety of upgrades of filters that will help the air quality. I would be very careful about introducing anything into the air which in any way either acts as a biocide or acts as a deodorant, or acts as any kind of chemical change in the air. Anything like that could really be suspect, and there are very, very few such materials that are approved by EPA or other such organizations for introduction into the duct system. So the most important thing is better filtration. The next most important thing is sealing the ducts from air leaks. So
no, but you know, David, forgive me, but aren't there also, there? And I can't remember what they're called, I have notes on this somewhere, but there are other types of heating systems that can be, you can replace the furnace and use the ducts with another kind of heating system. I think, is that what you're asking, Alex?
Well, no, I think he was.
Oh, he was on the right,
yeah.
Shut
yeah.
up.
So, okay. Yeah, well, and again, sort of related to what you just said, Lena, too, is that existing furnaces often pose a number of other problems, from backdrafting, carbon monoxide, you know, gas leaks, all of that sort of thing. There are sealed combustion, high-efficiency units that work better, that use less fuel, that are safer to use, and cause less pollutants to the air. And that is something that, you know, could be installed later. But the retrofit in existing, I think you're pretty much stuck with sealing the ducts, which is a very important element that most people don't have done. And the other is upgrading the filter system to either a pleated paper, to a passive electrostatic filter, not one of the electronic air filters, because they don't work. They simply don't work. But a HEPA filter or a carbon filter or anything that will in any way clean and purify the air, as well as taking out the dust particles, will be an upgrade from the standard cheap filters that you find in furnaces.
Are there actually devices that can filter out aromatic compounds? Or are those still
carbon? If you see a carbon block element in a filter, or an activated carbon element or charcoal element in a filter, that will neutralize odors, kill mold, and it will fix the chemicals.
Alex, thanks for your call.
Great.
Okay, let's get Tom on. Tom, we've only got about a minute, so quick.
Hi. I have an asbestos vinyl tile floor in my kitchen, circa 1960 about, that is slowly chipping away, and when I called asbestos information places and talked to other people that I thought might know, I was told not to peel it up, but to seal it.
So your question, because we're out of time.
Yep. And I wondered if that's what he...
The answer to your question in brief is yes, do not disturb it, because those fibers will get in the air, you'll breathe them, and it's carcinogenic. You need to seal it off as best as possible. It may be putting a new floor over the top of it. Encasing it completely would be the best bet. And you need to confer with a certified asbestos contractor to make sure that you're doing that properly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you for the question.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to make sure we got that in, the asbestos problem. Don't touch it. Another thing to remember, this seems obvious, please, people, don't use pesticides. Don't use ant sprays in your house. Don't use pesticides outside of your house. You know, call one of these biopest-style people if you must figure out other ways. Don't use pesticides in your house. They last forever. If people want to get hold of David Kibbe, who has been our wonderful guest here, they can call him at 510-841-1039. Again, 841-1039 in the 510. And if you want to get a copy of the Architectural Resource Guide, which lists different types of materials, and there's some very exciting new things in there, and information on all the different materials. So this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for coming over today.
Thanks for having me, Lena.
And thanks to the callers who had many interesting questions. If people missed part of the show and want to get a tape of today's show, or if you need more information, you can call my information number. Please call during normal business hours. And that's 707-769-1458. Again, 769-1458 in the 707 area code. For a list of other available shows, send a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope with two stamps to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Next week, I want to pick up where we started last week, talking about sugar sensitivities. We're going to talk more about this issue by talking about eating disorders, food addictions, and allergies, and how they relate to addiction. Julie Ross is going to be with me. She's an MFCC and director of